I think we all know the pedigree of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology when it comes to bird resources, and we at the ABA are excited to partner with the Cornell Lab of O to offer an amazing deal exclusive to ABA members. ABA members can now get a 15% discount to any new subscription to Cornell's amazing new Birds of the World resource that is applicable for 3 years. Birds of the World is a powerful resource that brings deep scholarly content from 4 celebrated works of ornithology into a single platform where birders can answer all their life history questions for every species of bird they could want. It is extraordinary. You can get more information at birdsoftheworld.org. Hello and welcome to the American Birding Podcast from the American Birding Association. I am Nate Swick. Flocko, the Eurasian eagle owl who spent the better part of the last year in and around Central Park in New York City after his enclosure at the Central Park Zoo was vandalized, has died. The bird was found severely injured, was taken to rehabilitation at the Wild Bird Fund, but died soon after. The initial diagnosis was traumatic impact, but at the time that I am recording this, there is no word on the results of a necropsy that would determine any additional cause of death. Certainly, celebrity birds in New York have in the past been the victims of rat poison and various other dangers inherent to living in a city, in addition to collision with vehicles or buildings. It's a tough place, particularly for a large predatory bird, even more so for a large non-native predatory bird. In the wake of Flocko's death, there have been thousands of words written about his impact. For my own part, I remain pretty ambivalent about it all. I'm not interested in discounting the very real positive impact Flocko had on a great many people who learned about nature, even if it was non-native nature, through and because of him. But I can't help but feel that this end was inevitable. Certainly from the moment that a number of people actively prevented the zoo from recapturing Flocko in the immediate wake of his escape. And I'm very much uncomfortable with the narratives that project our human responses and motivations to concepts like captivity and freedom on this bird, who is essentially doing what big owls do all the way to the end, hunting, hooting, trying not to get hassled by crows. But that's an important part of this, maybe the important part. Flocko's story is more about humans and our reactions to the natural world than it is about owls. It's about how a bird and a compelling story can strike a chord with the public. It's about how that story can be turned such that a bird would be more or less sacrificed for a little bit of social media cachet for some, maybe to open a wider world of nature to others. Would Flocko have been safer at the zoo? I think that's undeniable that he would be. He survived 14 years in captivity and barely one outside of it. Would he have been happier? I don't know. What is happiness to a bird? What is stress? Would his value as a mechanism for environmental awareness be more impactful in captivity at the Central Park Zoo as opposed to his year on the lam? That's the question I find myself struggling with the most because I truly have no idea. There's been a recent effort among some Flocko fans to get the city to build a statue of Flocko in Central Park. I am on the record as being pro-bird statue, the Great Black Hawk statue in Portland, Maine, that commemorates the long-staying vagrant bird that succumbed to the Maine winter back in 2019 is wonderful. But that bird arrived under its own steam. I am less enamored with the idea of commemorating a bird that was present as the result of a vandal's attack on a zoo enclosure and subsequent efforts to prevent its recapture. In my own opinion, that part of the story makes commemoration of that sort disqualifying. But there are some appropriate ways to remember Flocko, even if they are just sort of a fuller understanding of the difficulties birds face in urban environments. State Senator Brad Hoylman Siegel and a handful of other New York lawmakers announced that they were renaming the Bird Safe Buildings Act that requires state government buildings to have bird-friendly windows, the Flocko Act, meaning feathered lives also count. Very clever. This seems like a true and appropriate memorial to the owl that impacted New Yorkers' lives, and that in death, he may help in a small way to save the other birds he shared New York with. On the show this week, I apologize for the Gotham-centric nature of this episode. That's just the way things kind of shook out. But Chris Allieri, founder of the NYC Plover Project, joins me to talk about how to protect the tiny piping plover on the shores of one of the biggest cities in the world. All that after this week's Rare Birds. This is your Rare Bird Focus for the beginning of March 2024. Not a lot going on this time of year. That's sort of par for the course for late February, early March. But a stunning breeding plumage brambling in Croydon, Utah is the second such sighting in the interior west in 2024. Another brambling was in Colorado's Front Range in January. This wide-ranging and highly nomadic Eurasian finch is annual in pretty decent numbers in western Alaska. The island vagrant hotspots occasionally have numbers in the double digits and sometimes even triple digits in the western Aleutians. On the mainland, though, even half a dozen is exceptional. That said, this species can show up, and in fact has shown up, pretty much anywhere on the continent. There are historic records as far south and east as North Carolina and Arkansas, though most come from a broad swath across the northern continental U.S. and southern Canada. That's what I have for you this week. For the full list, check out the ABA Rare Bird Alert on Fridays at aba.org/RBA. You can also follow along with all the rare bird news on the continent in our ABA Rare Bird Alert group on Facebook and on ABA Community. Beach nesting shorebirds are one of the more nuanced conservation issues on the continent, not least of which because the sorts of places and times of year where they prefer to nest are the sorts of places and times of year that humans like to recreate, with all the attendant pollution and disturbance concerns that that entails. But it also offers opportunities to get people to care about these birds that we share this space with. And that is the goal of the NYC Plover Project, a group of volunteers who teach New Yorkers to share space with the threatened piping plover. Chris Ellieri is the founder of the project, and he joins me to talk about it today. Welcome, Chris. Is it getting to be plover season up in New York?
It sure is, Nate, and thank you so much for having me. Yes, the plovers are on their way as we speak.
Yeah, it's that time of year. Everything seems to be getting up there, checking out the spaces, checking out the territories. So when do you start really seeing plovers on your beaches in the New York area, sort of in earnest?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So again, just really super to be a part of this podcast. You've had some wonderful guests. And we're thrilled to be a part of that yeah. long list. The plovers are generally, they are very much creatures of habit. So they will be arriving in mid-March through to April. We get some of the same birds coming year after year on any beach nesting bird beaches like ours. You will sometimes see with the banded bird, you can see the story of them and know about them. We have one banded bird in particular, perhaps one of our most popular. His name is Clark Kent. He was banded by New Jersey Fish and Wildlife back in 2018. And he's been seen every season, but he is generally the first bird to arrive on New York City beaches. So we're really excited to hopefully welcome him back for his next season, but also other birds, which probably by the 15th of the month into April.
Yeah, they'll be on their territory doing their little dances and
double
sharing.
Space and territory, and they're getting there, you know, a few months ahead of us generally that are there. Yeah. But the American oyster catchers also arrive right around the same time.
Yeah.
They are definitely their frenemies, and they're definitely competing for space. But as our beaches are getting more and more narrow and more popular in New York City, there are a lot of stressors and challenges for these birds, and it's linked to habitat, but also to us humans.
Yeah, we'll get to that certainly. But can we talk a little bit about how this effort began, and what sort of issues did you see early on that prompted you to create this program?
If you had said to me a few years ago, you're going to be starting a wildlife conservation nonprofit very specific to birds or beach nesting birds or one species of beach nesting bird, I would not have believed you. But here we are, right? And so I'm a relatively new birder. I don't even use the term birder that much. To say I'm a conservationist or a bird activist. Sure.
Get you eventually. You'll be comfortable using it.
I think it's all just like the names, right? But my dad was huge into birds. My late father was huge into birds. He loved shorebirds specifically. I grew up on the beaches of southern New Jersey, and where our beach was closed for 2 miles of beach for a good part of the year for this piping plover. And I thought it was kind of like a unicorn. I never saw one up close. I saw one once from a federal employee from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service showed me as a young kid. And I didn't realize, now all these years later, that was my spark bird, and I didn't even realize it. But all these years passed. It was the early part of the pandemic. I was new to looking at birds in the city. I could not believe there were so many birds passing through the city, especially in our parks. And I discovered warblers, and I discovered all these other incredible little miracles of flight that come through our city each year. And I was out at the beach in the early part of the pandemic, and I could not believe it, but I saw piping plover, and then another, and then another, and they were all right in front of me. And then there were dogs off leash. There were people up in the dunes. There were kids up in the dunes. There were no signs, no fences, nothing. And so that first year, I was new to photography as well. And I picked up a camera. I started taking pictures of these birds, started shaking my fist at the world, you know, at both National Park Service and New York City Parks. Mm-hmm. And what are you doing? You know, we have to do more to protect this species. And it was getting nowhere. And it's also just not my style to just complain and not do something. So almost a year to the day later, in March of 2021, I saw the same thing again. Mm-hmm. And so literally I went home on the subway that afternoon. I said, well, what are you going to do about it? And I went online and I'm like, I'm going to call it the Plover Project or the NYC Plover Project, because project feels like it's not going to like take over my life. You know, it's not going to be quite as intense.
Right,
meanwhile, like the joke was on me. It's completely taken over my life and on such a tremendous and profound level, but in a wonderful way. And that I'm really just honored to do this work. And so it really was seeing hands-on this species for the first time, but then also essentially seeing that this bird was left to fend for itself.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something about that.
There have been efforts to protect piping plovers all up and down the Atlantic coast of the range and the Great Lakes especially. But, you know, the issues that are facing these New York City piping plovers seem particularly, I don't know, unique, difficult, because you have the juxtaposition of this threatened shorebird that's using these beaches that are adjacent to one of the most densely concentrated human populations on the planet. Yes. And these are people that also need open spaces to recreate and probably deserve open spaces to recreate. Like, how do you find that balancing point? How do you walk that line between what the plovers need and what the people of New York need?
That's such a great point. And I think that is what inherently is at the core of the challenge the NYC Plover Project is uniquely faced with.
Yeah.
We're a part of a broad coalition and a wonderful group of people across the Atlantic seaboard, Great Lakes states, the Great Plains states. I mean, anywhere the piping plover is nesting, we're a part of these groups. And many groups say, like Massachusetts Audubon, Maine Audubon, they have been doing work for decades, you know, for years and years, sort of building these cultures of conservation. But in places like the Cape or in coastal Maine, you know, really getting people on board, getting young people on board, education programs on the beach, you know, getting residents and private landowners and public landowners and really all of that work. What was very clear in New York City was that none of that was happening.
Yeah.
So yes, while we had two agencies, the federal National Park Service and the city, New York City Parks, these are very small cash strapped efforts. You know, these are efforts that are part of large agencies, but yet, you know, these are agencies that are dealing with tremendous budget cuts, right? So what it became clear was that we needed arms and legs. We needed people to help educate folks who go to the beach. So year one, Nate, it was all about, let's educate people who go to the beach. And literally hundreds of thousands, millions of people go to this same 10-mile stretch of beach in the Rockaway Peninsula. But for the listeners, we're talking about Southeast Queens. We're talking about the Rockaway Peninsula. It is in the Jamaica Bay ecosystem. There's 300 plus birds that are seen there on a yearly basis. It's a tremendous place. It's a biodiversity hotspot for sure. Mm-hmm. It's just but a few miles from JFK Airport. So if anyone's ever flown through there.
Seen it. I've flown over Jamaica Bay and seen, there's Jamaica Bay.
There it is. And there it is. And so what became very clear was that, like, we didn't just have an effort to do in the summer months. We had to do work all year long. Mm-hmm. So we'll probably get into this, but the work we've been doing lately is not only growing our volunteer effort, which I'm tremendously proud about. We've had 250 plus volunteers who perform something like 10,000 hours of service.
That's incredible.
And it's incredible. And we've gotten awards for that. And we were named Volunteer Group of the Year for the National Park Service and all of this stuff. But the wonderful thing, too, is that there is no roadmap for what we're doing with NYC Clover Project in New York, because dare I say, and I think my friends in Massachusetts, Maine, New Jersey, other places would agree with me, is that anywhere a piping plover is nesting, there is complexity. There are problems. There's going to be conflict, right? But I would say it's most acute right now in New York City. And that's what we're really showing up to do. Because, you know, I think some of our other partners and other organizations that have been really in the fold on some of this work, you know, they have multiple programs and multiple things they're working on. But with us, like, we're able to focus on this one bird, this one species in this ecosystem. We're really able to lean into the really difficult conversations. So yes, very long answer to a short question. Absolutely, you can balance the needs of humans with the needs of, or let's put it this way. We can balance the desires of humans, the desire for recreation, to the needs of beach nesting birds. And you see what I'm doing there, which is like,
I agree.
We cannot equate recreation on the exact beach that we want to recreate on to survival of a New York State endangered, federally threatened species. They're not the same thing. So we look at beach for fun, for, you know, for all of those things, for recreation. They're looking at the beach
for survival.
It's survival. Yeah. It's survival.
What exactly is the piping plover situation in the New York City metro area? How many pairs of birds are you talking about? How many miles of beaches are these birds using? Like, what kind of piping plover situation are we dealing with?
Yeah, so it's complex. It's absolutely complex. You know, millions of people go to this beach each year. There's both three different types of jurisdictions. There's federal parkland, National Park Service, Gateway, National Recreation Area, which is one of the most complex, but also one of the most popular national parks, probably one of the most, also one of the most complex urban national parks. And then you have, you know, this massive park system, New York City Parks and Recreation, which is part of the beach. And then you have a private community as well, Breezy Point Co-op, which is another part of the beach. So you have, and we have built relationships with both the federal side and the state, and we're working really hard to build relationships with the local community as well in Breezy Point. But the reality is that you've got about 100 piping plovers coming to the city each year. Not a lot, right? But if you look at the total population of somewhere between 6 and 8,000, somewhere around 2,000 on the Atlantic coast, you know, you've got a sense of, like, really, it is a small number, but you have, you know, such an acute amount of monitoring and an awareness of those birds that we are able to see, you know, when the numbers go up, when they go down a little bit. 2022 had a little bit of a spike, whereas 23 was back to, you know, it's somewhere between 48, 49 pairs.
Yeah.
So we have every reason to believe that they will be, you know, coming back in that same number this year. But you obviously want more plovers to leave that then arrive.
Exactly.
All of those adults, you know, absolutely. If listeners understand one thing, you want those adults to survive. So we absolutely have to keep those adults protected, right? But you want at least 1.5. And how does that work? You can't have 0.5 of a bird, but statistically 1.5.
More than one. Yeah.
Yeah. More than one. You know, we'd love to see four, but, you know, piping plovers lay their eggs in little shallow scrapes or depressions in the sand. I know this is a review for many, but, you know, these eggs are laid right on the sand. They're not up in the dunes. They're not oftentimes not hidden in beach grass or anything like that. And so the challenge against these precocial little birds is that they are up and running, literally running, not walking, up and running within hours, and they must feed themselves from birth. So to have one or two of a nest of four survive is a massive accomplishment, right? Not only for, you know, for the chick themselves, but for the parents. And then to way down the list for, to a small degree, us volunteers as well. And, you know, I really want to be mindful of that too, that, like, our work here is just getting started. We're really looking at this over the long term. And that's something that I've understood in conservation biology, but also endangered species biology, which is you have to look at this through the lens of the longer term, but also how is the state doing? How is the Atlantic coast population doing? So, you know, we've been sort of greeted and welcomed with open arms, and we've learned so much through this process. But for me, what I realized quickly is that this was not going to be the Chris Alieri project. This was going to be the NYC Pullover project. And, you know, we've built a staff. We have wonderful volunteers. We have volunteers that are coming from across New York City. Most of our volunteers have never picked up binoculars before.
Yeah,
that's most would never be able to identify a piping plover. But by the end, they're experts. And how did they become experts? They became experts through direct field observation. And there's no better way to become an expert in something but to teach someone else and to share that knowledge with someone else. And so that enthusiasm is sort of like boundless in terms of our volunteers coming in that wanted to be a part of a community, you know, didn't know much about birds or birding, but then
they're looking for the community.
We have a volunteer who joined us for our first year. And, you know, I would have to check in with this volunteer often and be like, have you left the beach yet? Because she was so committed. And now she just got a role at Audubon. Like, how cool is that, right?
Yeah.
This is a person that was connected to our beaches because of the connection to place. She really loved these beaches. And, you know, for us to like be some small part of her story to become, you know, to take on like a role in work for National Audubon Society, I mean, that's just, there's no words how cool that is.
Yeah, no doubt. What does a typical day look like for your volunteers? What are they going out and doing when they're working with these plovers?
Earlier in the season, like we'll have a smaller group of folks that are setting up our symbolic fencing, which is, you know, the sort of visual barrier, not the physical barrier, but that's kind of just the, you know, the gold standard in beach nesting bird protection, which is a couple of posts and some string.
Yeah.
And some, let's hope, different types of engaging signage and things. But, you know, we'll be out in the next couple of weeks installing that ahead of March 15th, which is a, you know, no dogs rule and no kites and some other things. But also that's an opportunity to start to engage people with Easter and Passover weekends coming in April. You know, we'll have a lot of people out there and people, you know, kind of out on the beaches and have an opportunity to have those early conversations. But as the beach nesting birds, you know, start to site, you know, their locations, their nests, they, you know, build those nests and they start incubating for about 30 days, we want to have as many volunteers on the beach during that incubation time, because oftentimes you cannot see these nests and the plovers are really blending in themselves. So we really try to get out there, you know, by April, May. But, you know, really the heart of the season, the core of the season is May, June, July into now August. And so we have volunteers literally from sunrise to sunset.
I was going to say, you have eyes on the plovers at all times for the most part.
At all times. And so we have volunteers that have gone through extensive training, which is not only shorebird ecology, so you can know what you're looking at. It's really empowering to be able to know some about these birds and to know their stories and, you know, the challenges they're faced with, but also conflict de-escalation. So if somebody's coming at you with like a, you know, conspiracy theory of the birds are put here by the government, or there are no plovers, or I saw plenty of plovers, and how to gently correct someone and say, well, you probably just saw sanderlings and they're wonderful too, but they're, you know, not plovers. So you know, just like, but also, you know, and those are kind of fun conversations to have, but they can get a little bit dicey and people have gotten, unfortunately, sort of out of hand with our volunteers. And unfortunately, those extreme outliers do stick out in our minds. So we want to make sure that our volunteers feel safe and supported and really a part of this community of people and of folks that really has their back. And, you know, throughout the season, what we're going to try to do is more and more engagement, more social activities for our volunteers. But also at the end of the season, you know, we have this big blowout party and, you know, everybody gets a different like gift or, you know, sort of appreciation gift. But like, I feel so strongly, and I've been a volunteer and involved with so many different causes in New York City over the course of my life, but I really feel strongly that we're the best gig in town. And I'm going to say that because it is so hands-on. It is so specific. There are no requirements for participation. We literally will accept everybody. And I think for us, what's really exciting too is that we're getting a lot of people locally. And I think that that local angle is so critically important because we could have 1,000 volunteers out there and that's not our goal, but you still wouldn't have enough, right? And so the idea is that conservation and that looking out for wildlife, specifically at risk and fragile wildlife, the community must have buy-in. They must see the value of this work. So if there's a bunch of fences and some signs and that's it, that's not building community. You know, someone once told me, and I mean, we've all heard this, but you don't build friends with a fence, right? But like, sometimes you need the fences, and that's federal law. You have to protect these beach nesting bird sites. But the reality is that we have to get the young people. We have to get the young and old, but the people that, you know, may have grown up down the block from some of these beaches, but never really got the message. And, you know, if I can just, you know, tell one quick story is like, we, our community engagement director, Mel Julian, like, she grew up in Rockaway. She lives in Edgemere. She found us on social media, on Instagram. Mm-hmm. She was like, oh, these birds are cute. These people look fun. Let me reach out to them. And I'm kind of simplifying here. But then she not only became a volunteer the first year, then she became our community liaison, connecting with Black and communities of color, but also connecting with folks that maybe haven't received the conservation message. And maybe, you know, in areas where shutting down the beach has been problematic and people are, you know, really up in arms about that, right? So now she's our community engagement director. But this is a person who, in her own admission, would have said, I never would have been able to identify a piping plover. And now she's doing this work on top of a full-time job, right? And so that's kind of like just one of many stories of the people that literally have had these transformative experiences, not because of me or our project, but because of these birds, right? They've witnessed this bird. Climate change, biodiversity loss, species loss, all of these social issues that we're being faced with can be really overwhelming. Understatement of the century, right?
No doubt. I think that's something that a lot of people feel very deeply, certainly.
Yeah,
certainly,
and if you see one bird and one bird in one species in one place, and I might have a hand in the outcome, like, that feels radical, right? And that feels radical in its simplicity. And I don't know why it took me this many years to figure that out, but that, like, organizations sometimes that try to do too much, and I was a part of those, is that you don't feel the connection and then you have burnout, right? But like, we have this intensity and these sprints of work, but then, you know, we have off time too, but now we've become very much a 12-month operation.
Yeah, and I think there's something to be said for the cleverness of tying this also to New York as well, because, you know, everyone sort of loves the place that they're from, at least somewhat, but New Yorkers, like, love New York. Yeah. And so when you've got these birds that are like New Yorkers, just like they are, there's a real connection there as well. You know, they're using these beaches the way we use them in some sense, but also this wildlife is right here in our backyard. It's New York's wildlife, and we've got to do something to protect it.
Oh, you hit the nail on the head. And this sort of idea of they are New Yorkers too is something that we've been getting a lot of positive feedback on. And it's what's funny too, is like, I've lived in New York more than any other place, but I wasn't born here. And I'm first to say that. And I know a lot of New Yorkers, a lot of people call themselves New Yorkers, we're not born here either. Some of these plovers are born here.
Yeah.
So they put one up on you, right?
And your neighbors,
this, this idea too, that like, we're going to look out for the most vulnerable, you know. If something were to happen to me in public on the street, I would want it to happen in New York, because I know 10 New Yorkers would run and do something to help me, right? And people that don't live here probably don't believe me, but it would happen. I hope you don't have to prove it, but it would happen. We want to see that sort of extension of concern, of care, of like, no nonsense. You know, we're going to roll up our sleeves. We're going to get this. We got this kind of idea. Here's the thing too, and for the New Yorkers and the whole like sports thing, you know, the New Yorkers versus Boston. Massachusetts is kicking New York's butt. Plover.
Yeah, they got a lot of them on Cape Cod.
I mean, the Massachusetts population is basically, you know, a driving force for piping plover's success in terms of, you know, ongoing breeding success. There is no reason why New York can't have that level of success, right?
So thrown it down.
And that didn't happen just, you know, by mistake. That happened because of work of Mass Audubon and so many other great organizations. But these organizations have been working really hard to engage community. And so for us, we know what has to be done. But I think sort of tapping into this idea that these birds are really vulnerable. I'd like to say sometimes that this is this sort of like the most misunderstood, most understood species, right? And what does that mean? It means that like, if you tell a birder, you tell someone who knows about wildlife, you tell someone who knows about the beach ecosystems, they're going to be like, oh, piping plovers, of course, I've seen them, done. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, like, the population of plovers, and this is sometimes used as a rallying cry for people saying like, oh, well, you're obviously not doing enough, so I don't know why you should continue, right? Well, which is terrible logic. But the idea is that, yes, the species have stabilized. The species has stabilized in terms of population, but it's not grown. Mm-hmm. You know, and so you were looking at certain populations, even within the Atlantic population. You know, the southern zone is doing terribly. And I know mm-hmm. you're from North Carolina.
So, yeah, we've seen that. You know, yep.
There's definitely a lot of things at play here. And the reality, too, in just the short period of time that we've been working, mm-hmm. how narrow beaches have become has become extremely concerning. And it adds another level of pressure onto the birds. And, you know, so much is riding against them. And then once they see the chicks, and you can see these like tiny little chicks that weigh, you know, the same as a few pennies, and they're literally running around for, it's supposed to be 26 to 30 days, but these birds aren't fledging in that amount of time. Fledging is being able to fly on their own, as in to the Bahamas, you know, like that's, yeah. you know, for their first fall migration come August, like that's not going to happen. So what the reality is that we're seeing from a fledging perspective, these birds are taking 30, 40 days. We had a bird last year, a plover, that took 50 days, 50
wow. huh.
days to fledge. And that's something obviously we flagged to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And, you know, I think that the status for piping plovers is up for review again. Should they stay as threatened? Should they, you know, should they go to endangered? And I would argue that, you know, 6,000 to 8,000 left in the world, that's an endangered species. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think the reality here is that you have a lot of people working hard on this. We're proud to be a part of this group of people. But the vast majority of the world are kind of like, yeah, birds, whatever, cool, go plovers, right? But, you know, they're for us. They want to see something good happen, right? And they see all of us out there with these blue t-shirts on. We give out stickers and buttons and temporary tattoos. And we're engaging and we're engaging, you know, engaging folks of all ages and all of that. And so I think people like to see this work. They like to see the things we're a part of. And we've had so many people join us because they've seen us.
Yeah. Do you find beachgoers just in general to be sympathetic to the issues facing these plovers once they're made aware of them?
I think they have to be made aware of them, right?
Yeah.
So like what we've learned over the last couple of seasons, and now we're heading into our fourth season, right? So mm-hmm. you can't lead with like a, you can't do this, or like mm-hmm. your dog can't be here. Or like, did right. you see the sign that there's no dog on the beach? Like
right.
that can't be the start of the conversation, right? So you have to give them the why. No dogs on the beach when I'm on the beach with my dog and we're having a great time. She's having a great time. She's got her favorite toy. All of that stuff is great. But like, we're just saying no dogs. You can't, it's like saying you can't bring your family here, right? And mm-hmm. that wouldn't go over well, of course. So I think the reality is like, hey, did you know that there's a threatened and endangered species that's nesting here along with that bird over there, the American oyster catcher, that are also federally protected? But here's the reason why, right? And we go into, they come here in April, they build their nest, their chicks hopefully appear by May, hopefully those chicks will fly by June, and then they're out of here, right? But the reality is, if they lose those nests, if they lose those chicks, they're going to try again. And then that pushes our nesting season into August. So I think what some people don't realize is that if we could, you know, get the birds, get them in, get them out, you know, they go back south yeah. again and they're happily on their way with their offspring, you know, that can open up the beach and that's happiness for all, right? But I think that yeah. the reality for a long time is that a lot of these rules were sort of like really badly kept secrets, or they were good kept secrets. I don't know. But like, you know, people didn't really communicate the
right.
rule. So,
yeah.
you know, a lot of this stuff has been left on like volunteers and seasonal, you know, seasonal employees of these agencies to have to communicate something that like most people's response is, I've been coming here for years and I never
exactly
heard about
right.
that.
That's
rule.
The right. issues that we dealt with here in North Carolina when Absolutely. They, you know, that there were a number of organizations that actually had to sue the National Park Service yeah. to get them to close the beaches. It was a, yeah. a political firestorm, let me tell you, but yeah. ultimately they did. But, you know, part of that was because the story was not told very effectively, and people will immediately get their guard up when you tell them, well, you can't drive on the beach anymore.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And it's tough, right? Because I think it's like, you know, some really well-meaning efforts like Share the Shore, like stuff like that. Like somebody could see that and be like, well, Share the Shore. I'm bringing my dog. I'm sharing
the shore with the other guy. Yeah.
But Share the Shore, dare I say, does not mean we share every inch of the same beach at the exact same time. So the reality in New York City is that while there are temporarily closed beaches, and those occur both on National Park Service side as well as New York City Park side, there is literally open beach on each side of it with guards, you know, and we have terrible riptides and undercurrents out in the Rockaways. And unfortunately, people succumb to drowning every year. So, you know, sort of swimming at unguarded beaches in New York City is never a good idea. But the reality is that on some of these unguarded beaches, that's happening, right? So the reality too is that you have to shut down some of these beaches temporarily if we're going to see any real nesting success. And why do we know that? We know that based on data. We know that based on facts from other places. But unfortunately, Nate, we know that from anecdotes. We've seen multiple chicks, unfortunately more than one, stepped on. We have photos of that happening, right? We have photos of dogs going off leash and entering, you know, areas. These are not sort of arbitrary rules that just sort of like make people's life difficult, right? But they are sort of really important to understanding. And I think, like, it goes without saying too, is that human commensal predators is a real thing. So if there's a bunch of garbage on the beach, or if we're feeding a bunch of outdoor cats or feral cats, that is absolutely going to increase, you know, invasive species, which is essentially outdoor cats, but also, you know, mortality of the chicks because of the trash on the beach. So without a doubt, humans are connected to so many problems for the piping plovers. But what we're trying to model through this work with NYC Plover Project is like, can we build this movement of New Yorkers that's positive, that can rally to protect this imperiled shorebird? Like I said, there's a lot of things to be concerned about. There's a lot of challenges facing New York City specifically right now. We have it pretty good compared to many places. But I think that maybe someone might ask, well, why should I care about this little shorebird? Why should I care about 100 piping plovers that come to New York City each year? And dare I say that a city that looks out for the most vulnerable, that a city that sort of in a way that is very hands-on and specifically tackling the climate crisis, I think that's a better city. And I think, like, if you want to see climate change in New York City, you'd be hard pressed to see it in a more specific and persuasive way than the story of the piping plover, that literally their nests are getting flooded. There's less and less beach for them to use. The increase of predation, like ghost crabs, which is absolutely connected to warmer and shorter winters and other things. So, you know, I think it's just one of many, many things to look at in terms of that level of engagement.
Have you been able to do work with other organizations doing similar work with piping plovers elsewhere in the bird's range? Have you been able to kind of establish maybe a best practices for engaging with the public about this sort of thing? Is there a best practices for engaging with the public? It doesn't sound like it.
I think that there is, though. I think that the engagement is you got to get out there. You got to be out there.
Essentially, you got to do it.
Early, often, and do not leave. You have to, you have to be constantly present and, dare I say, vigilant, right? And so if the piping plovers are out there and it's 90 degrees and there's spotted lantern flies or there's black flies or whatever might be out there that we're complaining about, we're out there too, right? And our volunteers are safe and we have sun covers and protection and water and all of those things. And we're really looking out for the safety and well-being of our volunteers. But like, we have to show that we're as persistent and as we're going to be as committed as the parents of these plover chicks are. And so I think the reality too is that, like, sometimes, and I think maybe some of the elected officials that first saw NYC Plover Project come on the scene were like, oh, you know, here's another group that's coming, or
short-lived,
maybe National Park Service probably thought that about me at some point, where probably like, oh, here's another guy complaining. Now they know that that's not the case.
Right. Yeah.
That we're in it for the long haul. And so I think that's number one. You really have to be ready to make that commitment, because you're not going to see the change overnight happen. But we absolutely are, you know, connected to this massive group of organizations in both the US and Canada. And, you know, when we first were started, like, I reached out to a number of organizations, and people just like were so generous with their time. And one in particular, you know, Ontario Plovers, Ontario Conservation of Piping Plovers, mm-hmm. part of Birds Canada, they had this idea of like, you should give out temporary tattoos. And her idea as well was also, you should lead with, hey, did you know that there's an endangered species nesting here, instead of saying no dogs? So
yeah.
That literally came from a best practice. And I'll tell you that those tattoos and the stickers and the buttons.
People love stickers.
People love it. People yeah. love it. And I think that that's really important. And I think what's really great for us, and just to pivot really briefly, is that what has become so critical to us now is the community engagement piece. Mm-hmm. So we're just as excited as, you know, with our connections to bird and conservation groups, as we are to other groups that are doing work within the Rockaways, but in other places too. So organizations that are focused on food insecurity, that are focused mm-hmm. on environmental and coastal resiliency, that are working on youth empowerment and youth engagement, right? These are organizations that we're building relationships and alliances with. And now they're inviting us to be a part of their programs and their stewardship of their issues and the work that, you know, are all of our issues collectively. So I think what's important too, and what we've learned, is that we cannot just be another bird group or a conservation group that just cares about, quote, just cares about the birds, right? Mm-hmm. That's an easy target for some folks to maybe don't like the work we're doing, to, quote, close the beaches or anything like that. But if they see us out there committed to other issues as well, like, we've done a series of community bird walks. We're doing one this mm-hmm. weekend. We do them throughout the entire year. We do it at a site called the Rockaway Beach Endangered Species Nesting Area. And for folks who don't know about it, please check it out. It's part of the New York City Parks beaches. It is the one public beach in New York City where 5 species of beach nesting birds are nesting. Mm-hmm. Least and common terns, American oyster catchers, black skimmers, and of course the piping plover. This is amazing biodiversity hotspot, yeah,
those right? Those are all really cool birds.
They are amazing birds. Yeah. And to see them in one binocular view or one scope view, to see multiple chicks or multiple fledglings all in one glance, is pretty tremendous, right? But unfortunately, there's a massive development called Arvern East going in just to the east of this site. Hmm. There's pressure to remove this site. There's people yeah. within the community that want to remove the site entirely. And even, you know, pressure to New York City Parks to increase access to this site. The problem is that you cannot have access without enforcement. Mm-hmm. And on some of the beaches of our city, enforcement is really less than to be desired. And so I think, you know, I'm not going to like call it out here, but I have to. And that reality is like, if we're going to protect these birds and also work towards increased beach access, we have to be able to enforce laws like dogs off leash, like dogs on leash. We don't allow dogs on leash either. Mm-hmm. And so these issues, I think, are so critically important. And we have to look at predators. And predators is a tough issue. Some people don't want to look at lethal predator management.
Yeah.
But again, to protect an endangered species or any species that's under the Endangered Species Act of 1973, it takes drastic, well, not even drastic, but it takes serious measures.
Yeah.
And without that, you're never going to see an increase.
Yeah. What kind of community engagement have you been doing? You've talked a little bit about that, like trying to reach the people on this local level, trying to get them engaged in the protection of these birds in their backyards. Like, have you seen people in those areas change their perspectives over the years with yeah. regards to piping plovers? Have you yeah. seen them, I mean, from maybe not even knowing that the birds are there at all, as you yeah. kind of yeah. mentioned earlier yeah. on?
Without a doubt, you know, and I think like there's a couple of metrics that with which we can see. I think number one, the amount of folks that come up to us and really sort of share positive observations or mm-hmm. you know, root us on. Or
yeah,
that
everyone has a bird story.
Yeah, everyone has yep. a bird story. And I love that people can get just as excited about that mockingbird. And somebody mm-hmm. came up to me on the beach the other day and we're like, I counted 17 songs from that mockingbird. And I yeah. was like, how great is that, right? Yeah. And the mockingbird's doing just fine in New York, thank goodness. But we can all come together and get really excited about the birds and excited about the wildlife that call New York City home. And so also, we've been a part of an effort with New York City Parks and Rec to do surveys of the community. And those surveys have been overwhelmingly positive. Mm-hmm. With the vast majority of local residents and visitors to the beaches alike, in support of not only protecting the threatened species and endangered species, but also closing part of the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality too is that connecting with young people. So in terms of community engagement, whether it's after school programs, whether it's in school programs or programs on the weekends, these are all activities that we're going to continue this year. We're actively, you know, applying for more grants to be able to do this work, especially as this sort of intense residential and commercial development is coming towards the Rockaways. I think like we're really going to be hard pressed to keep this site intact unless we mm-hmm. have more support from the community. So some of the things we've been doing, like I said, have been these consistent bird walks where we provide the binoculars.
Yeah.
There's no experts leading them. There's definitely some people with some expertise, but it's not that sort of traditional bird walk where it's just like, you know, somebody pointing out things with Latin names or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that also showing up in other places and in other fora. So, and in places that people would not expect a bird conservation group to be a part of. So like Christmas and community and holiday toy drives, you know, mm-hmm. we're co-sponsoring a food drive, you know, food insecurity in part of the peninsula where we're doing our work is really severe. And, you know, it's really important for us to show up on issues that are of importance to others, but to us all, and to make those connections that a healthy ecosystem and a healthy community is going to be something that is of importance, you know, to all of us, whether you're a piping plover or you're a human. So, you know, we're building some great relationships with some organizations like the Garden by the Bay, which is this beautiful bayside, bayfront community garden. And, you know, this is a group of gardeners that are really building this story towards healthy communities, but healthy nutrition, but also the resiliency of coastal ecosystems, of having permeable ecosystems and infrastructure. And so the front lines of climate change, as I said before, is really piping plovers in the Rockaways, but it's humans mm-hmm. in the Rockaways. And if yeah. you saw 10 plus years ago, Hurricane Sandy really hit, you know, the Rockaway Peninsula really head on. And so now one of the most important issues facing the community is coastal resiliency. So we have to do a better job, and we're trying to do that work very consistently. But, you know, free webinars, free talks. We're going to be doing a Black Birders Week event, which we haven't mm-hmm. announced yet. So I'm excited to share it with you here. But we're going to have, you know, a series of events during Black Birders Week. We're really going to like sort of unpack and dispel that model of, but, and I know a lot of your guests have talked about this, but really let's open that tent. Let's really mm-hmm. build that like cause for birds and birding and conservation in our city, like in a way that's really hands-on. And I think some organizations and efforts around, you know, the massive parks in the city that everyone knows about, like, you know, Central Park and Prospect Park and these great places. But, you know, Southeast Queens and the ecosystem there, the coastal ecosystem, is kind of this beach that not a lot of people, even New Yorkers, really think about. Mm-hmm. So I think it's for the residents, it's as important for us to engage with residents as it is for the thousands and hundreds of thousands of beachgoers that take their own private vehicles, but the subway and the ferry and the bus to get out to these beaches, right? That maybe didn't see these beaches as ecosystems. So I think for us, it's going to be a series of in-person events, webinars, showing up to other events. Like literally, we are putting up our table at any event who will have yeah. us. Literally any event who will have us. And that is where we're getting the best conversations.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I really do think that this community enrichment is such an important thing that I think bird organizations just in general historically perhaps have sort of forgotten. You know, sometimes we focus on issues specifically about birds, well-meaning, obviously, like people focus on this because that's what they're interested in. But, you know, we got to get all this community involved. We've got to get all these people, this larger community engaged in some of these issues too, because if it's just us, it's never going to get done. It's never going to be enough.
True. Yeah. And there is a really persuasive and urgent rationale for this community and youth mm-hmm. engagement work that we're doing. And we are already in public schools in the New York City public schools on the Rockaway Peninsula, but we're going to be K-12. We have a really exciting grant coming and some exciting work in the citizen science level of a local high school.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really excited about that work. But unfortunately, and this is atypical from other piping plover sites. So another thing that sets, unfortunately, New York City apart in a bad way, which is wicked nest vandalism. We've seen a series of vandalism episodes happening throughout the beaches. So whether it's the destruction of eggs, both for plovers, but for other species like oyster catchers, we've had adult plovers killed. We've had chicks stepped on, whether that was intentional or not, but we've had, you know, nests destroyed multiple times. And so, you know, this is obviously federal crime. You know, it got a lot of press last year because we pushed it, but also we pushed the issue, right, in a big way, because the year before there was even more vandalism and not one outlet nor any elected official paid any attention to it. They just sort of like looked the other way. That has changed. And that is something that has changed directly because of our work. You know, as you probably heard today, I am quite passionate, but I'm also very direct. And so I know what needs to happen here. And I think like the reality is that we will get more flies with honey, that whole thing. Mm-hmm. But there are some serious things that are happening here that are against federal law, right? So, you know, the agencies or the federal agency, like, we're not just doing this just because we're good people. We're doing this because we're following, they're doing this because they're following federal law. We are helping them by being arms and legs, you know, sort of foot soldiers, if you will, out there sort of implementing these rules, but also, most importantly, engaging people along the way through the process. So if you don't do the community engagement work, if you don't do the work in schools, if you're not sort of advertising in the local paper, if you're not putting articles in the local paper, and there's several local papers in our community, you will not move the needle and there will never be enough volunteers, right? And the volunteer effort will eventually fizzle. So you have to have people take it on. And dare I say, going back to Massachusetts, going back to Jersey, where I'm from, I haven't lived there in a long time, but you know, I have sort of have this in my roots of like people speaking up. And I'm seeing that more and more. New Yorkers speaking up for plovers, right? The first year, we used to get a lot of texts and a lot of emails, a lot of Instagram DMs saying, there's a dog on the beach and, you know, you people should do something about it. Now we're getting, there's a dog on the beach. I called National Park Service. This is what happened. You know, like people are really starting to take it on. And so I think like that for us is like sort of deputizing the listeners, deputizing the people that are out there. And we hit 17,000 followers on Instagram, and we're definitely one of the most followed conservation groups in New York City now that are local, you know, and we're one of the most followed in the community. And so that's a tremendous platform we have. And so a lot of people in the community, maybe we're getting some hate likes too, but like we're definitely getting engagement. And so I think it's been really fun, and it's an education, and like literally just getting started.
Yeah. Chris Alieri is the founder of the NYC Plover Project. You can find information about it at nycploverproject.org. Follow them on Instagram, hit them on the socials, find out what they're doing, and help them welcome back the piping plovers to New York here in another couple of weeks. Thank you so much, Chris. It sounds like you're doing some amazing work. Best of luck for this coming plover season.
Thank you. We will need it. But again, we're so thrilled to have the community on our side as well.
The American Birding Podcast is brought to you by the American Birding Association. Don't forget to join the ABA. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll be eligible for a lot of great benefits, including all of our magazines, online stuff like Magazine Archive, the new identification portal, our social media site, ABA Community, discounts to partners like Olympus, Beauty Books, Cornell Lababeau, and more. Special shout outs this week to Ronald Bruning II and Lori Liu of Tarpon Springs, Florida, Jennifer Fowler of Rapid City, South Dakota, Kathleen Haas of Wyoming, Michigan, and Debbie Holzgraf of Prior Lake, Minnesota. All of them recently joined the ABA, noted this podcast as a reason for doing so. Thank you so much. Welcome to the ABA. Executive Director of the ABA and Executive Producer of this podcast is Wayne Klockner, who correctly notes that Flacco the Eagle Owl and Joe Flacco the quarterback are both Super Bowl champions. Technical production is by John Lowry, who wonders if a third Central Park celebrity owl will come along, putting Flacco in between Barry the Barred Owl and a new bird, a Flacco taco, if you will. Additional help comes from Maggie Fitzgibbon and Greg Neese, who suggest that we get rid of all the fanciful collective nouns for groups of birds and return to the catch-all flock, which also is an appropriate commemoration for the celebrity owl because everyone already sees a Flacco ducks or a Flacco blackbirds. You can find us online at aba.org, on social media, most everywhere as American Birding Association. On Blue Sky, we're at ABA Birds. Questions, comments can come to podcast@aba.org. I'm Nate Swick. Thanks for listening. Bird Like Tom. We'll see you next week.